CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 51, with Carl Stonecipher, Lessons for Success in Cataract and Refractive Surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today we have a very special guest, Carl Stonecipher, who was a refractive surgeon before it was cool to be a refractive surgeon. Carl, welcome to our podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you. I guess, does that mean I'm really old or what?
No, you were just an early adopt. You started when you were 14, remember?
Right, that's right. I always call it serendipity. I was really lucky. When I was a medical student, I so happened to show up at LSU for an externship. When I showed up, the guy was a neuro-ophthalmologist named Henry Van Dyke, and he said, "I have nothing for you." I said, "Well, I'm here for 6 weeks. What am I supposed to do?" He goes, "Why don't you go work with that lady?" And so that lady happened to be Marguerite McDonald, and that happened to be around 1986. So I got to work with Marguerite McDonald as early as 86. And then Rousey had a talent laser, and he was at the university I was at McGee Eye Institute. And then it just kept following me as I went along in terms of Ron Kruger was one of my fellows. So Ron and I were one of the first ARVO project we had was on the femtosecond laser. We all say that's how we got our jobs. We kept saying femtosecond laser, and no one knew what a femtosecond was back in 1990. So, hey, it's a good thing.
Well, yeah, a lot of life is just kind of dumb luck sometimes, or serendipity, right place, right time. We have had Marguerite McDonald on our podcast. Wow, what an amazing podcast, because what an amazing woman.
She is an amazing person. Yeah, I agree. So,
Our podcast skews a little younger, so our listeners and viewers are usually 30s and 40s, maybe at the most my age, mid-50s. But tell them about LSU. People may not realize LSU, this is like the birthplace of refractive surgery.
Yeah, so I was actually a resident, and I'm still on staff at Tulane. But what people don't realize is LSU, Tulane, and another clinic called Ochsner all shared space. So when I was growing up, as a resident and a medical student, I had access to over 100 different staff. And one of the things that I want to applaud you for, because you say it over and over and over again, you don't have to be fast. If you're efficient, you're going to be fast. So if you figure out how to be efficient, you're going to be fast. And what these hundreds of surgeons that I got to operate with, they would always say to me, "I want you to do it my way first. And then once you've done it my way, you can go back to whatever you feel most comfortable with." So as a resident, the number one thing that I tell residents and fellows is if you see you doing something or me doing something, we may not even know we do that during surgery. It may not even be unusual to you and I, but to them, it's something new. Well, go back and try that. But one of my caveats about it being efficient is don't try anything but one new thing. So whenever I come back from academy or ARVO or ESCRS, my staff is like, you get to do one new thing, whether that's a new practice pattern, whether that's a new surgical technique. So introduce it piecemeal. Don't come over. It's kind of like I always say, Apple does very well because they listen to the people that make the, or use their products. And so they say, go out and say, what's wrong with the phone? Well, I'd like to have this and I'd like to have that. So they add it one piece at a time. Whereas Microsoft tends to give us a complete new, operating system. And I think that little snippet one at a time makes you and I use it and get more proficient at it. And then we're more efficient using our phone, and we're using our phone faster, whether that's texting or whatever we're doing.
I think it's a great point. Easy to change one little thing at a time to slowly evolve, as opposed to having a revolution where like overnight you must change everything.
Yeah. And the other thing I tell residents and staff members alike, but I'm saying I'm more focused on the residents and the fellows now, is I look at those guys and gals and I say, hey, this is not the time to be lazy. This is not the time to say, I don't want to go in at 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't want to go in at 5 o'clock in the morning to see that. Because that's when you get the great cases that you're going to learn from. And so nobody wants to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You go in, who knows what you'll be treating. I mean, we've treated some amazing things in the middle of the night. And what the most important thing about that is later in life, when you get that sitting in your lap and there's no one to help you with it, you've seen it before. So you've done one, you've taught one, you feel more comfortable with that, and you've got somebody to back you up as a resident, as a fellow. When you're out there on your own and you're looking over your shoulder and there's nobody there, it's probably because you didn't take that extra effort as a resident or a fellow. And I think that's important.
That's a great point. I would always tell my residents, I did academics half-time for 22 years, and I would tell them, the purpose of your residency is not the certificate on the wall. That's the least important. The purpose is for you to squeeze every drop of knowledge and experience and hands-on and know-how out of these few short years.
Yeah. And I say it to everybody, yeah, when I said I got a residency or a fellowship, I was like, yeah, dear God, just show me one of everything. And I can still remember walking out of Charity Hospital. This guy had a tumor out of the side of his head, about the size of basketball, walking into the ophthalmology clinic. It was my last day as I was going out the door. And I was like, well, at least I've seen it. You know, it's June 30th. I was headed on to my next adventure. But, you know, it was crazy stuff that came in. And those are the cases that, you know, you need to learn about. You may never see it again, but at least if you do see it, you can feel comfortable with it. It's kind of like I just got re-upped in ACLS. Now, why would I do that? I've now done CPR on a plane 7 times.
So 7?
Yeah.
You got to be here, guy. Buddy.
Wow. I know. I don't want to be that person that's sitting there looking around going, is there another doctor or am I just it? And then I don't want to be the hangover guy where you're really a dentist. You're not really a doctor. You know what I'm saying? So I think that there's been many times. I had a thoracic surgeon one time. I was running a code at a wedding, as a matter of fact. And the guy did great. We got him home and he lived and all that sort of stuff. But all the thoracic surgeon could bark orders at everybody. I was like, guy, if you're not going to, you know, come help us do chest compressions, are you going to do something? You just need to go get another drink because we're, you know, the Delta stewardess is helping me more than you are right now. So I think that, you know, those kind of tips to a new upcoming resident, you know, whether it's in cataract surgery, whether it's a cornea, whether it's a retina, you want to try and learn as much as you can while it's available to you, but you don't want to be unprepared either. So I always tell myself, or if I'm doing a new something, and you and I are always doing something new, if I don't know anything about it, I'll phone a friend. So if you were in the clinical trials for the Apthera lens, and I don't know anything about it, I'll call you up and say, hey, who's the first patient you would use this lens in? And how will you find it important in your practice? Now, of course, you're going to start off on label, or you're going to think on label and all that sort of stuff. But some of these things, when you start to adventure into the netherworld, you want to have somebody on your shoulder that may be in Australia or maybe in, you know, the UK or maybe in your backyard. And you just don't ever hesitate to phone a friend.
That's really great advice. Yeah, the collective brains. Is it, yes. You know, I have a feature on Cataract Coach now where someone sends me a video and there's a complication and I'm not sure why it happened. So I'll post the video and say, okay, I've got, in the first 24 hours, thousands of ophthalmologists see this video. Please comment below. Let's use group collective brain power and let's figure this out together. Let's learn together.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, helpful to the surgeon too. So a lot of times when you're doing surgery and something happens, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's the first case or the 21st case, you may not see what actually happened during the case. And so you and I are solo now. I mean, a lot of times we have, you know, just us and one member that's a technician that's handing this stuff that is looking at the screen, but her view, you know, may or may not be the same view and I have. I mean, we have the big screen TV now and they can watch it and kind of see better than I can, probably in the scope, to be honest with you. But I think for the most part, it's one of those things that a collective community, the ecclesia, whatever you want to say, is a good thing. It always helps you no matter where you are. So you don't want to burn any bridges, you know, as you're going along through life, because those people may be the people you're phoning later on to help you figure it out.
Right. No, all great points. In fact, one other thing I want to kind of backtrack. You said when you're a resident, learn or emulate all your mentors before you decide like you're going to do it a different way or your way.
Right. Well, and I got frustrated by that. You know, we would sit and tie and we would sit and do stuff that, you know, I learned how to do it and the gal would go, hey, no, you got to try it this way. And, you know, not always, but most of the time it was something that they were telling you that they had struggled with before and they figured out how to do it better. It was a better widget.
Right. And then similarly, I always kept an open mind. I tell every resident, if something I'm telling you, you have a better way, just speak up. Let's try it. Right. I'm game. I'm all looking to prove.
And if you can prove that to me, I'm game too. So if you're going to tell me I'm doing something wrong, okay, whether that's, you know, I shouldn't sew a wound 24 to 36 hours afterwards. I had a staff member in the ER tell me to sew a wound close. And I said, I'm not going to. It's Oklahoma dirt, dirty trauma. I'm not going to sew a close. And I got called before the board. So I went, the medical review board in the medical school. And I said, look, here's an article. That's why I didn't close the wound. I said, I cleaned it. I did what all the studies that I've shown, and they didn't get on me. They got on the staff member for telling me to close the wound. That didn't go over well with the staff member, but I'm saying if you're defiantly thinking that this is the wrong route to go, have a reason for it. I mean, don't just say I'm not doing it because I don't want to.
Right. Of course, think it out. If there's logic behind it, okay, go with it. Makes sense. Now, I got to admit, I've been on a plane before where they said, is there a doctor on board? Mm-hmm. And I sheepishly raised my hand, and there's a patient who's like, okay, they've got him laid out in the aisle of the plane. And I'm going there. I'm like, okay. And another doctor comes up, and he says, are you a doctor? I said, yeah. Are you a doctor? He says, yeah. And I said, what's your specialty? I said, ophthalmology? He says, I'm a cardiologist. And I said, please help the man.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I said, I'll do you a favor. I'll check his pupils.
Yes. Well, you can always do CPR, you know? I mean, it's the simple stuff.
But mine was easy. It turned out the guy just was a diabetic who took a big shot of insulin and then fell asleep before he had his meal. So he just bottomed out his blood sugar.
Yeah. But, you know, I just don't want to be that person, whether it's in the operative suite, I'm prepared. The other thing I tell new residents and stuff is, you know, during residency is a challenge, but get as much sleep as you can when you can. So rest is your friend. You and I, now they don't do it, obviously, and I'm not saying you and I walk 20 miles to school in the snow, but I'm saying you and I, yes, we stayed up for 24 hours at a time, or we stayed up longer.
In-house call for ophthalmology right here.
Of course, yeah. We never left Charity. I mean, you live there. You know, your wife came and brought you lunch or whatever, but I think for the most part, you know, I would say that you have got to get sleep somehow. Whether it's a cat nap here, whether it's whatever, you know, the studies show that even 20 minutes, I mean, you can't go crawl in the corner for an hour and a half, but even 20 or 30 minutes will bring your brain back. So, I mean, if you can find a spot, everybody's got 20 minutes or 30 minutes somewhere.
Right.
Sleep is your friend. Phoning friends is your friend. Even if they're your colleagues, you know, if you get depressed, go talk to people. Don't go sit in a corner. Don't hide. You know, I think that in this day and age, you and I don't get what COVID was like as a resident. I mean, I have one of my staff members whose daughter was a dental student during COVID. Can you imagine a dental student during, she did her second and third years during COVID. So here she's supposed to go out into the real world, you know, and practice dentistry because they still let them do animated and, you know, visual and virtual and all this crazy stuff, but it was not like actually doing it. So she went on to do a residency, but she still felt, you know, when I got out of dental school, I was a little bit nervous. And I think a lot of the people that you and I deal with are products of COVID training. And so a lot of the stuff may not be hands-on. And I think it is different, even though the virtual world is crazy cool.
Well, that's the good news too, is if you're a resident, and let's say you only did 100 cataracts during residency, and you think, gosh, I wish I had done like 300.
Yeah.
I'll give you a hint. 500 is not even halfway up the learning curve.
Right.
You'll be okay.
I have done 43,000 plus cataracts, and I still am learning. I've done 83,000 LASIK, and I'm still learning. There's always something learning that you can do in terms of surgery and improving your surgical skills. And if you ever get complacent with that, then you might as well walk out of the OR. You know, and I always laugh. My staff looks at me and says, okay, Carl, when are you going to quit? I said, when you tell me I suck. And so if your staff members are looking at you and going, oh, that case was kind of challenging for you, wasn't it, Dr. Stonecipher? You know, then I'm going to probably say, you know, maybe it's time for me to hang up the shingle, because you're always going to be a doctor. You know, I mean, you just don't want to be one that they say it's time for you to leave. And that's my second pearl for the podcast of the residents. Have fun, you know, enjoy your residency. That doesn't mean, you know, go out and drink like a fish until you can't come home the next day. But, you know, you got to have outlets too. So as residents, we would do journal club, and have a volleyball match at the local beach bar or something, you know, and we would try. I mean, New Orleans was a great place to do residencies, and we would always infiltrate the residency program. So I know you're in L.A., and I know USC and UCLA may not always get along, but we call the other residencies programs, and we would say, hey, let's all go meet, and let's swap, you know, stories. And
I like both. I like them both. I went to USC for med school and UCLA for residency. Believe me.
Yeah. But I think that one of those things you get is their staff, too. Right. So everybody's staff has different ways and different thought processes. So I can still remember we did a plastics training with live, fresh, frozen cadavers. So they had just recently died. And we had every plastics person, plastics from the community, plastics from LSU, Oxford, and Tulane. Now, I never wanted to do plastic surgery, but I thought that was one of the coolest wet labs I've ever done and felt like I felt comfortable being able to sew. And everybody's got to sew something at some point in time in their life. And I think that even if you're putting a button on, you want to be good at it. You know what I'm saying?
That's true. So what was your path? You finished your training.
Yes.
And then what did you, what were the positions you had after that? What was your path?
So I always tried to make myself better. So I started at Tulane. Then I went from Tulane residency with Rousey because I'd worked with him in medical school. We worked with the Taunton laser, which he had just gotten rid of, and we were working with the microkeratome. So I started working with keratomes back in the mid to late 80s. And so I had access to a summit at Tulane, at Taunton with Rousey, and I'd had access to a Visex with Marguerite. So I would always visit all these people, and I would just be like a fly on a wall. Then I had a month or two off, so I went out to Stanford. I'd never had really that opportunity to sit down and do the basic science. So I went out and hung out at Stanford for 6 weeks and did their basic science course. Then I went to AFIP because I got done early.
Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in D.C. Yeah.
So I went out and learned pathology. And then I went, I still hadn't started. I was about to start my practice. So this is after my fellowship. I had time before I started my practice. And I just went back and hung out with Rousey. And we put 7 ARVO papers in that season. And it was when I had the opportunity to work with Ron Kruger. So Ron Kruger and I were going up to Oklahoma State University. We had this amazing lab that had all these cool lasers that we were double and triple and quadruple frequency in their harmonics. And we were working with femtoseconds and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And then after that, I started working a very large practice. So I was lucky. My practice was, I was very itinerant. So I went to 29 offices and operated in 9 cities. So wow. I was constantly doing surgery. And that's why I'm a higher volume surgery probably for it. But I learned that skill when I was a fellow and when I was a resident, because we were pretty high volume in residency. I mean, I was the guy that you didn't want the open globe. I was going to go in at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning and do it. You know, I always told everybody I would do anything. So if you didn't want to take it, I'll take it and go do whatever we have to do with the residents or the fellows. I don't care, because I figured that that's how you're going to get your hand skills better. And then, you know, I've always been in academics like you, but I'm on the opposite end of the coin. I started with UNC back in, that's been probably 15, 20 plus years, and started working with the residents because I enjoy it. They come to me and I go to them sometimes at UNC. And then Tulane asked me to work with them. So I'm trying to do more with my old alma mater and still train there. But primarily in private practice, we now do a lot of FDA clinical trials like you. You know, whether those are pharmaceuticals or nutraceuticals, or whether those are actually IOLs, or we're doing new dry eye stuff. And, you know, that's kind of, we've got a few minutes left. I'd like to tell you what are you doing cool these days? What's your coolest thing on the planet you're doing?
I think for me, the coolest thing right now is just tailoring the specific approach to every patient, even complex patients. So when a patient comes in, let's say prior RK and needs cataract surgery now, we have so many more lens options available. You mentioned a small aperture lens, which I've now started to incorporate. I'm even finding that some of these patients putting an EDOF lens helps to mitigate some of that diurnal corneal fluctuation from the RK.
Right.
I think just the challenge of meeting every patient and figuring out, okay, of all, I incorporate as many tools as I can in my toolbox. And then of all these tools and technologies, what can I do to give you your best possible vision for your needs? And that's the fun of it.
Yeah, and to your point, that's my talk at ACOS. It's coming up. It's looking at 30 years of surgery, but right now I've done so many, whether it was RK, PRK, LASIK, whatever, those are the people that are coming back to you and saying, hey man, you made me see really well. Now can you make me see again that I've had, you know, my cataracts develop? And I am now, I just presented 3,710 cases of the different style of lenses we're using. I love your platform, and I'm not saying that because you and I are on it. I think you need to learn about Q values. I think you need to learn about how different things affect the optical system, why an RK fluctuates, why a PRK can haze. And now, you know, one of the cool things Wilson has shown us with Losartan, we're using now Losartan in our practice with corneal scars. And for those of you, we don't have time to go into depth in it, but if you'll go to YouTube and put Steve Wilson in and put in Losartan and corneal scarring, he talks about Oxervate, mitomycin C, and how we're now using this topical compounded drop. We're using it in RK scars. We're using it in herpes scars. We're using a lot of different stuff. Actually, my dog got a scar after cataract surgery. She got a corneal scar, superficial scar, and I've used it in her, and it's working well in her. I mean, you know, I really like you to think through the process. And if I can't figure it out, I'll phone a friend. We're now using artificial intelligence a lot in dry eye. So I'm now working with a group out of Canada, which is csidryeye.com. And that is allowing me to be a better diagnostician. So you think, oh yeah, well, you know, dry eye, it's just like a dry eye with mixed, or it's a dry eye with aqueous, or a dry eye with evaporative. And realistically, there's a lot more co-conspirators now, whether those are medications or there's, you know, systemic disease. And so I think that the co-conspirators help me better use all these plethora of new tools like XDEMVY and MIBO and Vivive and all these other new LLT and IPL and radio frequency in my practice. And those can make me money. Those are the, I always look at YouTube and I laugh because they're always, how can you make passive income? And every day I'm always thinking, how can I make passive income? How can my practice make more? And dry eye is one of those ways in which to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a full spectrum of disease. It's not just what we're thought like, oh, the eyes are just dry and replace more tears. And you know, you're right. You need to now have a full armamentarium basically to deal with anything that comes in the door.
And your cataract patients are going to get dry. Your LASIK patients are going to get dry. You're going to have other things. I mean, I even deal with the Tapiza. You know, that's kind of one of the last pearls I'd probably leave the guys with and the gals with. And that's, you know, look, I know medicine's expensive. I get that. But I looked, trained with endophthalmitis early on. Harry Flynn and I are good friends, and we'll argue over what your postoperative antibiotic regimen can be. And I don't think I'm HIPAA violation here, but Harry went total generic with his drops. And I mean, I've heard him say that from the podium. He said it to me on several occasions, but I'm that guy that wants to kind of use the latest, greatest of everything. And I went back just recently and looked at, I keep track. One pearl I tell the residents and the staff is to, you know, look at your cases and keep track of what you do. I do it on cataract, and the reason I do is because I can always go back and look at what lenses I'm doing and how I'm doing. I do it in refractive as well. I do it in an Evernote. So if I go and I have a weird thing like DLK, I put the person's name in and why I think they got DLK. Or if I go back and I have a CME, I go back and I look and see,
you know why,
did I do a generic? I said, did that person's, you know, pharmacy or my wellness pharmacy make them get a generic because their insurance didn't pay for it? And you know, the funny thing, I looked at the recent, I don't see it very often, but of all the CMEs that we looked at, every single one of them had gotten a generic ketorolac because their insurance had required them to.
Well, I have actually switched completely for many years now to doing just a compounded drop with whatever I want in it.
Yeah.
So I'm using for cataract patients compounded drop that has moxifloxacin, bromfenac, prednisone on the same bottle.
But for you, moxifloxacin may work and it may not for me. So I constantly look at my antibiograms at the hospital. Yeah. They're easily to access. So if I look at moxifloxacin, wait, I'm not denigrating a sector, but our pediatric crew around here where I live, uses a lot of moxifloxacin for conjunctivitis, whatever red eye there is. And so right now, moxifloxacin only covers staph about 80%. So I've completely switched to other, you know, one of the surprising drugs that works really well now is gentamicin, because nobody uses it anymore. Right. So I look and see what's available. What's available? Polytrim. What's available? Gentamicin. What's available? Gadifloxacin. And look at those drugs and see what's available. And then I'm totally for trying to make it easier for the patient. You put it all in one bottle, they only got one bottle to deal with.
Well, even easier, zero pharmacy phone calls.
Yeah.
And I don't even charge the patient for the bottle. I just put it in their hand. My gift to you.
That's just good.
It just made life so much easier.
Well, I think your staff definitely loves you for that.
Yeah, for zero pharmacy phone calls, no prescription. Give the drug. But I think that's kind of the way we're heading with this, where, you know, when you see a problem, like a problem we had was, okay, how many pharmacy phone calls can we field in a day? Oh, God, this isn't covered. That's not covered. Now you got to do this paperwork, that paperwork, this exception, this pre-authorization. Are you joking? I don't have time for this.
Right. And, you know, the other thing about it is most staff have done what? They just hired another staff member. So they've kind of fallen into line and said, okay, I'm going to go with that. You know, in our refractive practice, I still don't have EMR because I don't need it. You know, a lot of these patients come in, they're seen, and then they're done. Now we keep their charts, obviously, for the allotted time, but I will look at my charts from my refractive side, they're about this thick, and I'll still look at my EMR charts from the other side because of phone calls, because of Xerox or stuff you got to put in there. Right. And I really find that the paper charts work better sometimes for me on the refractive side, even complex cases.
Oh, it is for sure. I mean, we sometimes simpler is better,
and I think that's important, whether that's in surgery are in life. I mean, sometimes simpler is definitely better in terms of, when you can find that easy route or that easy button, mm-hmm. take it. But at the same time, sometimes a harder route is a better route to go. And, when I'm looking at patients these days, I'm always constantly thinking, okay, how am I going to deal with this person? Okay, so let's say it's somebody I did do refractive surgery on years ago and they're back. I can always say something that my uncle, who was a cardiologist, taught me. He said, Carl, if you can treat them like family, if you can say that with my brother, my mother, my father, my sister, whatever you do, you're going to sleep at night for. So if you can go and look at that person in the face and say, I'm going to do that to you because that's what I think is best for you. I think if you still have a complication, you're always going to have a complication. I'm blocking on the surgeon. Vern Parmley used to say it all the time. He was at, used to run the Madigan Armory Hospital. But he'd say, if you never cut, you'll never cry. And it's totally true. You're always going to, if you have a complication, own up to it. I don't like go and bleed in front of a patient. But at the same time, you got to tell them, hey, it didn't go as good as planned. But always give them hope and say, yes, it didn't go as good as planned, but this is what we're going to do to make it right.
And don't abandon them. Be their advocate. Be with them. Don't abandon them. Absolutely.
And that's how you don't get sued. I mean, the angry patient is the one patient that comes in and sues you. And I and you have done medical legal work throughout our entire careers. And I would almost tell you most of the malpractice cases I've seen are because a patient, they didn't listen to the patient.
Right, the patient thinks you don't care. Mm-hmm. When there's a complication, like you said, the only surgeons who don't get complications are the ones who don't operate.
Right.
No matter how good you are, you're going to have a complication from time to time. But when the patient has this issue, all you got to explain to the patient is, I am here for you, and whatever it takes to get you back to good vision, we're going to do it. I'm going to be right here by your side. And so with that drop nucleus, yes, we'll have the retina surgeon see you tomorrow, get that PPV, PP lensectomy done. Get you fixed right up, you'll do great.
And you and I know great surgeons who have all dropped nuclei.
And I'll tell you, 100% of cataract surgeons
who've done dropped nucleus. Cases. Yeah, right. And if you haven't, you're not telling the truth usually. But if you've dropped a nucleus because of poor anatomy or not poor anatomy, then you've got to own up to it and say, what am I going to do to make this right? Now, don't. Dear goodness, don't go diving for the stuff. Now, if you've got retina training and you've got retina surgeon training, you can go do a pars plana vitrectomy. I don't care if you know how to do it, but don't make that your first case, you know. But right. My retina surgeons, I'm blessed with like six locally or more now that basically they'll say, Carl, do what you can, remove as much cortex as you can, put a lens in if you can, as long as you think it's going to be stable. And then, yeah, I'll come up and do what's ever left over in terms of whatever case. But, you know, you and I do the crazy cases. You know, I just had a myotonic dystrophy yesterday, or, you know, a sublux lens, or all sorts of different stuff. And yes, we know and have trained and been trained and learned how to do all that stuff. But I think at the same time, you know, if it's not in your cup of tea, either you don't have the patience to do it or you don't want to do it, then there's plenty of surgeons around you that will.
No, for sure. Absolutely. The phaco probe is not a fishing pole. Don't go fishing in the vitreous cavity.
I've seen that a lot. And I don't right. like, you know, you're like, whoa, cowgirl or cowboy, you got to hold off on that a little bit.
Well, you know, especially now with patients getting so many intravitreal injections. For retinal vascular disease, for macular degeneration, for whatever else, the incidence of like damage to the posterior lens capsule from intravitreal injection is more than you can believe. And so the rate of drop nuclei among very talented surgeons keeps going up because right. you may not realize it. Patient comes to you with a pretty opaque cataract. You do a little hydro dissection. You just pop the bag open because right. it got nicked before with the intravitreal injection.
And you know, more and more, I like you, know my retina surgeons. I talk to them. They're friends of mine. We go to dinner. I may have operated on their mom, their dad, their family members. And I'll be the first to call them up and say, okay, something, I'm not sure, something doesn't look right before surgery. Now, did you nick a bag or is there anything? Do you have any? And some of them will come clean. But most of them now will kind of say, hey, I think this may be a harder surgery than you think. So maybe you'll want to use a femtosecond laser on that person to do mm-hmm. more of the lion's share of the work before you get in there. So I think that it's that phone a friend thing that I go back to. So don't ever hesitate to phone the referring surgeon or the phone the referring person, whoever that may be, if they know anything ancillary about this person yeah. that you need to know, because there never goes a day. And the one that I hate is Accutane. So I will constantly see patients on Accutane and it dries up everything from A to Z. Right. And I had a professional baseball player. He went on to get a AAA World Series ring and a real World Series ring. And I still remember when I operated, I'm in high school, he was throwing about a 92 mile an hour fastball and got up to 97, 98. And so I had seen this guy had operated on him and he was young. He wasn't that nearsighted, but you know, he's trying to get in the show, or he was in the show. They were drafting, but he's trying to get from AAA to the real deal. And he's out in Cuchamunga, California.
I mean, Rancho Cucamonga,
California, probably the driest spot on the planet. And he can't see. And he calls me up. I'm like, dude, man, when you left me, you're like 2010. He goes, I can't see. So Roger Steiner, love the man. I said, can you see this guy? And he goes, Carl, this guy's cornea is just dry as a desert. And I'm like, he didn't have that before. So finally, I started going back to him. I'm like, is there anything that you could have taken? He goes, oh, yeah, I didn't tell you. I took Accutane. Because, you know, we all have Accutane on, no Accutane, no Accutane on all of it. And I said, why didn't you just tell me you had taken it before? We could have taken some preemptive strikes. He goes, I was afraid you wouldn't operate on me.
Oh, boy.
That was his line. So, but in the end, he ended up fine. He got World Series rings and lived happily ever after. But, you know, prod the patient if you don't think they're telling you the whole story, too. You know, it's like a patient I had yesterday. You know, we're talking about the difference between whether you do an ICL or whether you do laser vision correction, and she's a better candidate for an ICL. And she said, well, you know, I have ankylosing spondylitis. And I was like, well, I'm glad you told me that. I said, well, that just enters into the pattern that we have to discuss that with your primary care provider and see if that's stable. And, you know, and maybe you phone a friend, you phone somebody like Scott Barnes, or you phone somebody that's smarter than you about it, that may have done more cases than you, and say, you know, the company's going to say this. You know, I got it. Don't do anything outside the box. And that's your mantra. But at the same time, you're always going to get patients outside the box. And then what do you got to do?
You got to choose. For that case, what did you choose? What did you choose for that case?
I haven't operated on. She and I are still going through the process. And so I think that for her, we either paint her in a corner, which is what I've told her with LASIK, or we go ahead. But, you know, her percent tissue altered, which I look at, is about 42%. So she's right on that borderline of whether you're going to make her too thin. Now, you're not going to cross-link her before or something like that. And I know you and I did 43%, 44% early in our career because we never had percent tissue altered when we were growing up. But I think that you know, we always have to think about how a patient approaches coming to us. So one of the final pearls that I would say is a patient comes and sees you why. They want you to pick something.
They want your opinion.
They didn't come to hear you talk about the Vivity and the Synergy and the Rainer. They want you to pick something. So what I do, and about 80% of my practice, 85% of my practice, it's really 83%, I know the number, is premium. So how do I do that? I do that because I pick two lenses. I say, this is what insurance pays for, and this is what I would put in you if you were my mother or my brother or me. Mm-hmm. And then after I'm done with that, and I've operated on those people. And I say, after I've done that, you've got to choose economically what's healthy for you. And you will laugh, but I will talk to them about, do a GoFundMe page. You don't need new tennis shoes. You don't need new anything. Go tell your kids to do a GoFundMe page for Christmas or whatever. And I think that what people don't realize, the Canadians did a great study that I just happened to be the moderator for the panel at ASCRS.
Tell me.
Canadians have shown that with extended depth of focus lenses, what happens? People fall less. They break less ankles. They break less shoulders. They break less hips. And they fall less because they can see that range of vision. And I will talk to the patients about that. But I think that the patient wants you to make a decision for them. Now, economically, never judge a person. I have people that come in with overalls on and one undone and sitting there and saying, hey, buddy, what do you think I need for my cataract surgery? And I never judge because that person can be worth $2 billion or he can be worth $2. And I don't know. So I always tell them, this is what I do and this is why I'll do it. And it's not always the most expensive option. So like with, you know, pellucid marginal degeneration, I'm putting plain Jane torics in those people and they're doing phenomenal with that. They find that little multifocal spot in their cornea. Mm-hmm. I can align that cylinder up. I use intraoperative aura and I've now done, I don't know, close to 100 or more pellucids. And I've looked at the numbers and they're all averaging around 20/32 uncorrected vision. As long as I have a lens that matches that level of astigmatism. Now I'll still put in say a Alcon T9 in a person that's got 10 diopters of astigmatism, because you'll be amazed at how well they see. You know, yeah. I've looked at patients after I've done that, and still they may have 2 or 3 diopters of astigmatism. I'm like, well, you know, we can get you glasses, or maybe you want to go back to wearing a contact lens. And every single one of them, not all of them, have said to me, Doc, no, I've never seen this good. I'm fine, you know?
Well, it's because they have astigmatism on the brain. Right. If you've looked your whole life through that much astigmatism, your brain has astigmatism. And yes. Your brain likes that. It's like me being a low myope.
Yeah.
Please never make me dead on plano. Leave me like minus a half. I'll kiss your feet.
Well, and those people live in an El Greco painting. Everything's long. You know, you live in a near world. The minus one is the perfect refraction. Right. You know, it really is, because all your life you do everything you need to do. You know, now I will leave you with my favorite story. Marguerite and I both have funny stories, and I don't know if she told hers about how she found out she was nearsighted. Well, hers was it's a long story, but short in the stick, she thinks she's running across a parking lot and she runs into like a retaining pond. And everybody's like, what are you doing? Well, mine was, my dad was a professional baseball player. And so one of his friends, who also was a very good football player at the University of Oklahoma, came to him one day after they had played golf. And he said, Stoney, I got to tell you something. Your son is the worst person on my team. He can't play. I'm so sorry to tell you that, but you better hear that from a friend. Well, of course, you know, my mom takes me to every doctor known to man. I finally end up with Dr. Stan Muntzer, the guy who wrote my medical school recommendations, wrote my ophthalmology residency recommendations, eye doctor, and says, he just can't see. He needs glasses. And I was about a -5, and I just lived in a -5 world. I sat at the front of the classroom and I didn't get glasses till I was like 11 or 12. I just didn't know any better.
So what'd you have done eventually? LASIK?
LASIK, yeah. Okay. So I've had LASIK now for 30 years. You know, I had it when I could have it. You know, I mean, I waited for technology to develop. I had really severe dry eyes. I had one of the fellows do my punctal occlusion. It runs in my family, dry eyes. And so I did my punctal occlusion. We got everything kind of squared away. And then I ended up doing LASIK. Mickey Gordon. You know, I gave Mickey Gordon, I wanted to pay him. He wouldn't let me pay him. So guess what I gave Mickey Gordon for my LASIK?
What's that?
A Mickey Mantle baseball card. So I had Mickey Mantle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so my dad signed for the Yankees early out of college. And so anyway, I had all these famous players like Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, and wow. Tom Sturdivant, and Billy Martin, and all sorts of crazy people around us.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, when I was teaching residents, which I did from 2000 to 2022, any resident who wanted LASIK, I do it for free.
Of course.
Just come, we'll do it for you.
I usually charge them $1. And so I say, you got to pay me $1 because I don't want you to think I'm just getting you off. You're getting off lightly. So I'm going to charge you $1. So when somebody says, did Carl charge you for your laser vision correction? Well, he gave me the family discount. He charged me, but he gave me the family discount.
That
sounds better.
Oh, that's awesome. So you tell me about your practice now. So your practice is obviously very busy. You do both IOL surgery and corneal refractive surgery.
Yeah. So one of the things that we got smart with, and whether you agree with it or not, you know, I'm a big co-managing physician. I always have done that. I have 523 different primary care providers, optometrists, all this sort of people that refer into me. So many of my patients come from 3 hours, an hour, 2 hours away for refractive and cataract surgery. Not that I'm the best in the world. They may pass through other things. It's just the doctor has recommended me for that reason. The reason I'm telling you that is not to impress you with those numbers, but start collecting those people's what? Email addresses. I put them in a constant contact. And so I'm constantly keeping them up to date with what lenses I'm doing. So I don't want them to be surprised. So if I'm starting to use a new lens like the Apthera or the Aspire, and they're not familiar with it, I'll put a little constant contact snippet in and I'll send it out. And it's a real easy access to do. So on my refractive side, I can do paperless. So on my refractive side, I have a lot more leeway. We split that up in about, I want to say 2005. And it just got to be easier in terms of Medicare patients versus non-Medicare patients. Cash pay versus non-cash pay.
So how do you split your week up then?
So I do Mondays and Wednesdays clinic on my cataract and my functional side. Tuesdays is all day surgery cataract. Thursday, Friday is all day surgery on the laser vision corrective side. And I'd probably do a 2-to-1 LASIK to cataract.
Nice. Now you travel a ton too. I've seen you at, I don't know, half a dozen meetings in the last 12 months. How do you fit that in your schedule as well?
You know, traveling for me is part of my learning experience. So sure. I was in Australia, Vienna, Budapest. I was in Mexico. I was in California. I was in New York, Miami. And that was just last month. That was just within the last probably 4 months. You're right. And I think that for me, you know, Paul Singh's like me. We like to go places. Some of them are missionary related. Some of them aren't. But I think that what I like to do is learn. And so that's one way for me to learn. Seneca said it best, even while we teach, we learn. And so I think that's why I do that. I also do that for one simple reason, and that's because if people see me out there, they know that I like doing the latest, greatest. So it's how I get a lot of my clinical trials so that I can still be involved in the FDA and be involved in FDA functions. And then you and I, you know, meet a lot of cool, crazy people along the way. And so I've met a lot of really neat people, whether that's inside ophthalmology or outside ophthalmology, whether that's industry or outside industry. And so traveling for me is part of the fun of it. And, you know, you've got to find something. I have a lot of friends who are practicing now or maybe not practicing who never really found an outlet other than cataract surgery. And so when they got to the end, they were like,
what do I do now?
What do I do now? I'm a cataract surgeon. You know, that's what I've done all my life. I'm a LASIK surgeon. Their neck's all messed up. They can't, you know, play golf because their back hurts. And so you got to start doing the yoga early. You got to start stretching. You got to start seeing the massage therapist. I've got me a nice massage chair that I sit in after surgery every day. So spend your money wisely, save appropriately. But at the same time, you can't take it with you when you're gone. I mean, you're going to provide for your kids. You're going to provide them with, I mean, ophthalmology, we're lucky, right? We're blessed in the sense that we know where our next meal is coming from pretty much for the most part now and ongoing. And ophthalmologists are at the top of the tier. So we're always going to figure out what, how to make passive income. We're going to figure out another way. And when you look at me and say, oh, that femtosecond laser is not good, or oh, that, you know, lens is not good, don't denigrate the way somebody does surgery, especially another surgeon in your community. Now, if they're messing up eyes, that's a different story. I would privately go to that surgeon and say, hey, I'm seeing a lot of complications from you. But I never, ever, when I see a complicated case in my community or outside my community, I'm like, hey, look, you've had a challenge. Well, I want to talk to you about what I think the doctor did. Well, I don't want to talk about that. I'm here to try and figure out how to get you to the next level. I need to figure out what's wrong with your eye. How are we going to move forward? Now, you can get as negative as you want to, Mrs. Johnson or Mr. Johnson, but I really wouldn't, that's not going to help me help you. So if it helps you, I'll sit here and listen to you complain about it, but it's not going to help you get better. If it helps you, I don't know, psychologically, I'm still, my next comment's going to be is, how do we get you better? How do we get you to the next level? And then on the other side of that coin is your staff. Mm-hmm. Look and see what patients are wearing out your staff. Like you said earlier in this phone call, the patients will wear your staff down, whether it's over pharmacy or whatever. And if you have that challenging patient, I'll pick up the phone. I'll say, especially if they cuss out one of my staff members, I'll come up and I'll say, hey, you wouldn't want to be spoken to like that. Or maybe you get spoken to like that, but my staff does not. So I'm always, I'm in that knockout round for my staff all the time. And if I can't convince you to treat my staff well, I don't care what you say to me. I'm like you, it falls off my back. But if you continue to abuse my staff, I finally look at you and I say, look, you know, we're having a bad relationship here and it's time. Here's 10 surgeons. You know, I'm usually sending them not to the people I love to. You know, Terry Kim would always laugh jokingly, you know, in our questions. We'll like say, what would you do? I'd send it to Carl or I'd send it to Terry. You know, if it's really the bad complex case, we do that. I mean, every now and then Terry will have a patient that he'll send to me and say, you know, go see Carl because he may have something I don't have. Or I'll send it to Terry. And I'm like, dude, man, I have thought and thought and thought about this thing. You're much smarter than I am. You go and figure out, you know, what's the story. And it's kind of like they've got, you know, other surgeons that he may show the case to. And they go, oh, yeah, this is X, Y, or Z. And Carl just didn't see it. I don't get offended by that. I want the patient to get better.
Well, we all want the same. We all want the best for the patient. I know for the young ophthalmologist, one of my most important pearls. You see a patient come to your clinic, had the first eye done somewhere else, obviously had some challenges, not the ideal outcome. Give the first surgeon the benefit of the doubt.
Of course.
This patient has such bad protoplasm.
Yes.
The second you go into you're going to go into the second eye, you're going to start that Rex, and that whole nucleus is going to wobble back and forth. Then the iris is going to come down. Then you get an iris prolapse. And then you'll think back and say, wow, now I get it.
Yes. And that's so true. And I mean, and you're always going to have a patient. So I have done 83,000 plus LASIK. Not telling you that to impress everybody. I just 83,000 refractive cases. And I had a guy today that was, and I love it. He was a super nice guy, but he's a Neanderthal man. So his eyeball was sitting on his cerebellum. And of course,
big brow. Yeah.
And of course, he can't wear contacts. So he's like this whole time. Yelling at a patient does no good. He doesn't want you to screw his eye up. He's sitting down there thinking, okay, what can I do? So you got to stay calm. They've got to stay calm. Your staff has got to stay calm in the room. And of course, we got through the case. The guy did fine. But boy, you know, even you and I run into challenges every now and then. We're like, set back. Take a deep breath.
Right.
What Lisa Arbacesser will say, when the room goes dark, you know, when the room goes dark, you just got to kind of sit there for a second, catch your breath. But you sitting there yelling at everybody, the patient's awake. We forget that. The patient's awake. They're like, doc, why were you yelling at the staff? Or why were you, throwing instruments or why were you? And I've never done that because the patient's going to hear all that and they're going to go, I think something went wrong, you know?
No, absolutely. I mean, the way you handle that, of course, is that the more calm you stay, the better the outcome for everyone.
Okay. Now, every now and then you got to look at your staff, and one of my staff members said this to me, and they're chatty, Kathy, you're doing something and you may be having a challenge in your case. You're like, I need you guys to focus. So you have a safe word. I need you guys to focus now. And then they know that, okay, I got to pay attention because something just, went different. You know, it's not just that typical 3-4 minute cataract, something changed and we got to focus.
No, for sure. What are the best lessons you've learned the hard way over your last many decades of practice? Because you've done an amazing job of obviously building your own practice, both cataract and refractive and kind of the whole spectrum of refractive surgery, but also in the involvement with industry. It's also being on the podium. You've been to dozens and dozens of countries. What are the best pearls you picked up along the way?
So you're going to laugh at this one. It's called listen to the patient. So in this day and age of EMR, the first thing you and I do is go sit and look at that computer. Now, I make it a point when I walk into the room, I make eye contact with a patient. I'll either introduce myself or they'll say, oh yeah, you look just like I saw you on the webpage, or you look like, they'll make some comment back, or they'll, oh, you did my mom or you did my father, or I was referred in from somebody. So you make some kind of point of contact. After you've done that, then you can look at the chart. Then you look back at the patient, and I always use similar lines. So I have two, and these are my two biggest pearls that I would go with, and I try and keep it simple. Number one, when I'm looking at the patient, I say, look, I'm a one-fix-it doctor. Don't expect a lot from me. What can I do for you today that you're going to walk out of this office and I'm going to fix? Now, that can be a person with a cataract, or that can be a person with a complication. But at that point, they're going to tell you, and if they start going off the scale, yeah, you're going to have to interrupt them. You can't be there an hour and a half because you got 35, 40 other people waiting on you. So you've got to focus them. But at the same time, you've got to find out what the problem is, because if you never find out the problem, you're never going to fix it. So if they're a cataract surgeon, a cataract surgery patient, you got to know, are they a truck driver who loves to tie fishing flies? Are they a seamstress who loves to drive back and forth across the country to visit her grandkids? I mean, you got to know what their hobbies and their habits are. And listening to the patient is so hard in this day and age, because you're all about how fast can I get in the room and how fast can I get out of the room. The second pearl along those lines is never, ever let a patient sit. So if I come to your office, am I going to sit at some point in time? I'm going to sit, right? So while they're sitting, show them videos. So we have I have a folder on a computer, and every room has a computer now because of EMR. So I have folders and folders of videos. So if they're for laser floater therapy, then I basically have video that they're watching on laser floater therapy. Now, the attention span of anybody is what? Tops
10 minutes.
I try to make every video sub 5 minutes. And it may be a video I've done. It may be a video you've done. I use a lot of your videos when I'm talking about, okay, look, we're trying to compare two different lenses. Good friend of mine, Uday Devlin's got it. It's made for doctors maybe, but if you go listen to it, you're going to pick up some pearls along those way. So the video component, I think, is very important. And then at the same time, you have to enable your staff to do things. Now, they can't do brain surgery, right? You and I can't do brain surgery, but you've got to let them do what they can.
Of course,
so
delegate.
Let's say simple things like I do what's called the 90-second workup. And the 90-second workup is I put OSDIR speed at the top of the chair. Okay, they got to take those tests at the beginning. Whatever, you may do the Dell questionnaire or some type of questionnaire, but you've got to learn something about that patient. Then I put in fluorescein, not fluoresce, and Lissamine Green. But I keep saying I put it in. I don't. My staff do. Because they can go 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi and do a tear breakup time. Or they can look at a stopwatch. Or they can do fluorescein stain and say, oh, wow, the central corneal stain is. What's that just done? That saved me half an hour. Because they look and they see central corneal staining that's fluorid all over the cornea. They're still talking about cataract surgery. We'll still put them in the queue to schedule them for cataract surgery, because I don't know how good you are, but we're at least 4 to 6 weeks out. for a cataract surgery. So we still put them in, but that with the newest tools in our toolbox, we can still treat that person. We'll bring them back and repeat testing. And we may not do a lot of testing that day, depending on how dry they are. But that gives us the opportunity to illustrate to them, my staff, hey, you got a dry eye. And everybody pretty much has a mirror somewhere. You know, a lot of us reflect mirrors in our eye charts and stuff. So if they've got lissamine green stain, I just tell my staff, go over there and have them look in the mirror. And they're like, whoa, look at all that green there. And I'm like, yeah, that's why we're going to talk about your dry eye. And then last but not least, with all of these patients, the way that you get them where you think it's appropriate is you decide what's best for that patient. And we talked about it for a long time. But you, the number one thing you've got to do is you're the person they're coming to see. You got to get it in your head. You're the expert. And if you're not the expert, you need to figure out how to be the expert. You know what I'm saying? Go watch your videos. I'm not making that up. A lot of people watch your videos. Go watch somebody else's videos. Go to CME. Go do something that's going to make you the expert if that's what you want to be the expert in. I don't do retina surgery. I'm not a glaucoma guy. I'm not the guy to do that. But if I get a patient that has some issue, I may call Paul Singh and say, dude, man, this patient's got this. You know, who would you send it to and what would you do if this were you? You know, and I do that all the time. Phoning a friend is my number one thing because why? I get to talk to you. Sure. That's number one. I get to ask you how your family's doing or what we're up to and all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, they're the expert many times and never, ever think you're the smartest person on the planet. It's just it's like gambling. If you're looking around and you're trying to see who the fish in the room is, it's probably you.
No, that's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. I mean, well, those are absolutely great pearls that are hard to learn along the way. But
you can learn cataract technology and techniques. You and I can learn that anywhere. But what we've got to learn in the hard knocks through life are what you did wrong. Experience just basically means you've done it wrong before. And hopefully you learned from how you did it wrong and got better the next time, you know, well, in terms of whether that's you tore a capsule, you know, or whether you were doing something you thought was right and it turned out to be completely wrong. And it was just because you were doing something that you didn't know how to phaco chop and you'd gotten to learn how to conquer and divide, or you didn't know how to, you know, use these lenses appropriately. And you took somebody with hyperopic LASIK and put in a negative Q value lens that makes them even more negative. And I keep seeing that every day. People come in with the wrong lens for the wrong patient. Surgery was perfect. Mm-hmm. Surgery was absolutely impeccable, but they put the wrong lens in the wrong patient. And there's ways to figure that out if you'll listen at the very beginning. And the patient's going to tell you, oh my gosh. And you're going to go, oh my gosh, I don't want to do that. That lady doesn't need a trifocal lens. Yeah, maybe she's got a perfect retina, perfect cornea, but she didn't have the personality. It's like one experience I've learned that maybe you haven't yet in all these years is if you're really good, and I'm talking professional, because you and I have operated on a lot of athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have a pro golfer right now, great vision, distance intermediate near, he's 20/20. He's got only one eye done because he doesn't want to do the other eye because he doesn't like this one. And I'm not going to say what I put in the lens in the eye, but it's perfect. And he just doesn't like it. And it's an extended depth of focus lens. I've got a 5-0 tennis player. She had to have this lens because what? All her friends had that lens. Mm-hmm. She was afraid they were going to be better than her. Well, her friends didn't play tennis. All her friends played other sports. And so an extended depth of focus lens worked for them. But for her, who's the 5-0 tennis player, she was losing the ball through the lens. Now, we didn't end up taking it out, thank the Lord. But I think that, you know, we were able to work it through and get her to a point where everything in her optical system was perfect. And she's still winning all the tournaments and still doing well. But I think that how do you learn what lens goes in what patient? Find somebody that's put it in before you. And I don't care if that's overseas. A lot of people, surprisingly, you get what at the bottom of CRST and OSN? You get their emails. And if you're quiet about it and you don't give them some dissertation and you say, I got a patient with this and you can keep it short, you know, short. This is my problem. Do you have a solution? You don't give them 10 reams of paper that you've taken 80 years topography on them. You say, this is my problem. You got any options?
Like you, I get emails like that every day. I reply to every one of them. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially if you keep it short. Keep it short and sweet. We'll get right to it. Happy to help you. Now, I think you went through a lot of important lessons. One is the difference between a mistake surgically and a lesson is you learn from a lesson. So if something happened in a case, it's imperative you go back and watch your surgical video and dissect that case and learn from it. That's a critical thing. And another great takeaway I got from you is, and this is super important for the ophthalmologists who have no gray hair yet, give the patient a specific recommendation.
Right.
Mrs. Johnson, based on your measurements, your needs for your vision, your anatomy, your everything, the best choice lens for you is this.
Right.
Do not give a laundry list. Which one do you want?
Okay. Because it's just going to confuse them. Right. And you know who I learned that from was one of my partners. I'm in the room. I'll never forget it. God rest his soul. Mark Ralston, he's passed away. And I'm in there talking about this lens and talking about that lens. This is about 20 years, 2007, 2008 or something when all these new lenses are coming out. And I'm telling him about it. And Ralston goes, hey, his office is right behind the room I was in. He goes, come in here. I walk in and he goes, I want you to do me a favor. Don't say another word. What? He goes, I just want you to walk in that room and say, it's broke and we're going to fix it. Now, you can't say anything else, but you're going to go in there and you're going to say, and I'd already talked to this person for 30 minutes or more. I walked in, I look, and I'm like, Miss Johnson, it's broken. We're going to fix it. And she goes, okay. That was it. So all he said was, you're the guy. I mean, he taught me that. He said, you're the doctor. You decide what she needs, and she'll take it. Now, don't get me wrong. There's the neurosurgeon or the rocket scientist who has basically researched everything, and you got to look at that person and go, you know, you've done a lot of research. You're a smart cookie. And for you, I think because of your habits and your hobbies, this is what I do for you. And I always use those two terms because if you got a guy that's a pilot and they love to tie fishing flies and you don't address most of those problems, they're going to come back to you and they were minus one before surgery, you know, minus one and a half before surgery. And like, doctor, you made me worse. I could read. Now I can't read. I can't do what I used to do. And you're like, well, I thought you wanted to be zero. And we do, even with small, we see dense cataracts, but we don't see a plethora of dense cataracts. A lot of the cataracts we see are previous LASIK patients and stuff like that. And sometimes you can still, in their contact lenses, you know, if they're a virgin cornea or if they've had LASIK, you can put a contact lens in them and show them what a mini monovision might look like or something like that. Because we do a ton of mini monovision. And the biggest thing is don't get so stressed out about the 2020-ness, 20 happiness, and teachers have that. Oh my gosh, it never fails that a referring doc or one of my staff will go, oh, Miss Johnson, you're only 2030, or you're only 2025. Well, she started to count fingers. She's happy. She walked in happy, and now you open Pandora's. Well, what do you mean I'm only 2030? Should I be better?
Right.
Yeah, so.
Right. And especially, let's say she wanted to be minus 75 or minus one instead of Plano. Of course, you're not 20-20 for distance. But
yeah. And the other thing, when it comes to, you were talking about this earlier, a complication. When you have a complication, own it, but don't walk in the room and go, oh, Miss Johnson, I just screwed up your eye and I'm really feeling bad about it right now. You know, you go in there with confidence and say, hey, the case did not go as good as I expected. And so we went ahead and we did this, we accomplished this, we got to this point, but after that, we didn't get where we wanted to be. And so now I'm going to fix it next venue, or I need to refer you to someone who has better diagnostics and tools than I do. And we're going to get that set up, but we're going to take care of you and I'm going to be your doctor, you know, and that's how you deal with it.
And you got to look at the bright side, the patient with that drop nucleus, when they get that pars plana vitrectomy and lensectomy. No more floaters the rest of your life.
I know, right?
You got an amazing quality of vision there.
Exactly.
And then, it's funny. And those ones, which actually we're seeing a lot more, when a patient comes in now with a history of intravitreal injections, I'll do a very careful retroillumination, red reflex image of the slit lamp just to make sure there are no weird things going on in the posterior capsule. And if there's no view, I always look at lens thickness on the biometry.
Right.
If that lens thickness is like 5.5 or 6 millimeters, Houston, we've got a problem.
Right. And you know, and the biggest thing is, like Jack Holliday, you say, that's like you're looking through a marble. But the you know, in terms of looking at people like floaters, you know, if I see it on the table and I didn't see it before, I'll be talking, okay, Miss Johnson, you know, you got this big old floater back here. You know, you had that, right? And that floater was there before. You know, I'm having that conversation before I'm done with the surgery. You're probably going to see it better after cataract surgery, but we're going to do something with that, whether it's laser floater therapy or you're going to send them to a retina surgeon down the road and fix it. But I said, if that's a problem, because Eric Donenfeld, you know, love the man, and he'll like, you know, if you don't tell him about their epiretinal membrane or their dry eye before surgery, it becomes your problem. You know, you got to tell them before surgery, or it's your problem. You know, it's not their problem anymore.
Oh, such great pros. Man, I wish I listened to this podcast about like 25 years ago. I was just starting out in practice. This would have been so amazing.
We can do the time warp thing.
I know.
The time we spent together.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for doing this podcast. I smiled the whole time. I had such a great time chatting with you. You're such a dear friend in ophthalmology. And again, I've learned so much from you. We learn so much from each other, which is what I love.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again. And I want to remind our viewers and listeners, check out every week, every Sunday, a brand new podcast. And tune in on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get podcasts. Plus, of course, it's on YouTube and on cataractcoach.com. We will catch you next time.